Welcome to Radio Survivor. We're here for the love of radio and sound. I'm Jennifer Waits.
And I'm Eric Klein.
And I'm Paul Riesmandel.
On today's show, we're going to take a look at Native Americans' use of sound technology during radio's earliest days and how that inspired and led to the flourishing Native media landscape, including tribal radio stations. Our guest, Josh Garrett Davis, is associate curator at the Autry Museum and recently completed his PhD dissertation on this topic. Josh, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. And as someone sort of working in the field of Native American studies, I often start by sort of acknowledging that I'm here on Tongva lands in Los Angeles, and that at my job we work with Tongva community members and educators on a lot of topics, and Native people from a lot of places have taught me a lot of these things, but to make that first and foremost in terms of sort of locating myself here in Los Angeles.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. And I'm really excited to have you on the show talking about this dissertation work, which the title of your project, Resounding Voices, Native Americans and Sound Media, 1890 to 1970, it's really right up our alley at Radio Survivor, because we're interested not only in the early days of radio, but also in how some communities have been left out of the historical narrative. And we've talked about how that has related to women in radio, people of color in radio, and even student broadcasters. So This is certainly the case for Native Americans. And I'd love to ask you, just first of all, why it was important for you to research these very early contributions by Native American people to radio and sound.
Yeah, I mean, I did start from an interest in the present day, I think. I grew up in South Dakota, where probably about 10% of the population is Native, and had spent some time on various reservations there, on kind of both through friends of my dad and through... I became interested in Native American history in college like 20 years ago. So I had been around Indian country, as they say, which is kind of the way of describing... It's a legal construct, like in federal laws, Indian country, but it's also sort of a vernacular for sort of the landscape that Native people control, whether you'd say that is the whole continent or the specific places where there's a density of Native communities. So in Indian country, I had noticed, just listening to the tribal radio stations, there's two major ones that I had heard in particular in South Dakota, Kili, K-I-L-I, and Kini, K-I-N-I, on the Oglala and Sikandju Lakota reservations, kind of in the southern part of the state. And I was really interested in the role, just as a kind of observer passing through and turning the dial to this, the role that the radio seemed to play in terms of, event announcements, a road might be flooded out at a certain point. And then, the music was kind of what you might expect from kind of community radio anywhere, of a kind of freewheeling mix of country western, powwow music, hip hop, all sorts of things, depending on who is on the air, but pretty similar to community radio anywhere, except with the indigenous sort of spin on things.
Was that some of the first community radio that you were hearing?
Well, I was a college radio DJ. I suspect probably all of you were.
Good to hear that, yes.
And so I had participated in that. So this is another sort of backstory of all this. We'll eventually get to the early 20th century. But I became interested in the politics of radio while in college, and was even a music director and program director by the time I was a senior at WAMH in Amherst, Massachusetts.
Nice. Of course, I would have asked that later. Very good.
But while I was working on the radio, I did the first kind of research paper that I had done in Native American history was about the occupation at Alcatraz Island in 1969, 1970, 71. Just exactly 50 years ago right now, it was going on. And as part of that, John Trudell, who is a Santee Dakota activist and poet, ran a show every day for, it was only, I think only 15 minutes or 30 minutes from KPFK. Is that the Pacifica station in Berkeley? Is
KPFA.
Yeah. Sorry, the KPFK is here. Called Radio Free Alcatraz. And so I was interested in that. And then I simultaneously, there was this thing going on at our radio station where people at the county jail would call the station. You may have kind of come across this, and like make a collect call to the radio station. And in the space where you say your name for who's calling, they would say their song request and then hang up because they didn't have the money to actually, like, we weren't going to accept a collect call, but they would just say, like, you have received a call from the Hampshire County Correctional Institution. The call is from, and then play Jimmy Jazz by The Clash. And then, like, they'd hang up. And so then you would play. And so this, there was this sort of metaphor happening in my head of, like, a prison.
They hacked the call system to get a free call into a radio station because they were listening to the radio in the prison. We've talked about prison radio here on Radio Survivor in the past. So that's right up our alley.
And I know. So, and
I
Alcatraz
love that.
2
I love that
was
use
a prison.
Of college radio. Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, the fact that Alcatraz 2 was this prison that had been kind of hacked in some sense for what's sort of thought of, it's actually a few years into what's called the Red Power era. But the first really, really visible national action of the Red Power era, and that there was this radio component. That was just sort of struck me, and this, I was 20 years old at that point. This was a long time ago, but
can you tell us about the Red Power? Just give us a gloss on what the Red Power era is, because unfortunately, I don't think this is often taught in schools.
Yeah, that's true. It isn't, and it's starting to be a little more. But the Red Power era is beginning in the 60s. I think a new generation of Native American activists from all around the country began to converge, and to sort of, there had been Native American activism for generations in all sorts of ways. In the 20s it meant something else, in the 50s it meant something else. We'll go into some of this in a minute, but there was a sort of new stridence, you know, in conversation with everything else that's happening, Black Power and the women's movement and Chicano movement and all these kind of this resurgence of a new generation of activists. And so there was a sort of new militancy that some of the first really visible things that happened in 1964 up in the Northwest were fish-ins, where tribes who had treaty rights to fish in certain rivers and other watersheds had been restricted by state game wardens and things from fishing in certain seasons and certain times. And so they just went out and did it, and kind of got arrested and things like that. That was maybe 64, 65 that started to get really a little more attention. And then Alcatraz was and actually there was an early brief occupation of Alcatraz Island in, I think, 1964, where, because Alcatraz had become abandoned property, federal property, somebody found a statute that said that in some treaty that said, you know, if there's abandoned federal property, it goes back to the tribes. So they said, well, sitting right out here in San Francisco Bay, there's this abandoned federal property, let's go take it. But that the first one was a very brief and kind of quickly kind of shut down. And then in 1969 was the end of 1969 was a bigger, more organized occupation that ended up lasting for more than a year and included this radio show through Pacifica.
Yeah. Now, KPFA continues to commemorate that occupation with broadcasts every year there's a sunrise ceremony. If I'm not mistaken, it's on or around Thanksgiving, and it's a dawn broadcast that that commemorates the occupation of Alcatraz. It's almost like a reoccupation because they broadcast live from the island.
And there's a even a little before Alcatraz, there was a program. I just came across this and working on an article on Native American radio. So I've been learning a little more about the more recent history that in my dissertation, I really focused on the early half of the 20th century. But that there was a program on the New York Pacifica station called Who Speaks for the Indian, in which some of these activists, a guy named Mel Tom, who is Paiute, I'm trying to remember some, Vine Deloria, really famous scholar and activist, and others sort of were, this was one of the first mainstream sort of radio, and I don't know if you consider Pacifica mainstream, but one of the first sort of radio appearances for where Native activists got time to speak for themselves. And this was probably in the 65 or so. And then Alcatraz, and then the New York station, what's WBAI? Is that what it's called? Yeah. They did another show that has just recently been archived and digitized called Seeing Red, of Joy and Frank Harjo, or Muscogee Creek, or not Joy Harjo, that's Suzanne Harjo. And Frank Harjo. And it's at the Institute of American Indian Arts in Santa Fe. They recently, as part of Suzanne Harjo's papers, they got all the tapes of these shows, and they recently digitized them through a grant. So they're up on the IAIA, is the shorthand for that school, on their website, on their archive. So there's Pacifica played a really important role before there were true tribally run stations in the 60s and 70s. So that's kind of a... And so this, the Red Power movement continued. And of course, the most famous moment was the occupation at Wounded Knee in South Dakota, my home state, in 1973. That was a really long militarized standoff with the FBI and holding a small federal building in Wounded Knee with the American Indian Movement. At this point, had this organization had kind of become the main face of Red Power. And that's during the moment when Marlon Brando declined his Oscar during that occupation. And it really put Native people back in the kind of wide public consciousness. As I said, there'd been activism going on for decades, centuries in some ways, but Native people continually kind of are, as you said, underrepresented, invisible in a lot of mainstream consciousness. And so that moment really kind of, they became front and center, you know, and there were sort of, there was the occupation of the BIA building, the Bureau of Indian Affairs building in Washington, D.C. in this time, and a lot of actions, and it just kind of was a real renaissance and had a lot of repercussions for decades down the road. So that's the Red Power movement in a not-so-small nutshell.
Yeah.
Well, but it helps us also kind of put it together with radio, right?
Yeah.
We can see how it came into your consciousness in part. I mean, there's the news of the day, of course, but as well access to the fact that some of it was broadcast.
I wonder if it's... I want to jump around. I mean, it's not really jumping around. Josh Garrett Davis, you started telling us about radio stations that you were listening to when you were younger in Oklahoma that were emanating from Indian country, reservations, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, and then you just referenced during your description of the Red Power movement that those radios, they haven't been around the whole time. When did those stations come along and how are they, is everyone different or is there a pattern across the country?
Yeah, so the ones that I mentioned in South Dakota, where I grew up, they started in the late 70s and early 80s. So in the wake of the Red Power movement, there's a radio component. And in the early 1970s was when you started to have tribally run stations, or maybe if not run literally by the tribal government, that they were connect, you know, owned or operated by Native community members in some form, whether through a nonprofit or whatever. So starting, there are a lot in Alaska, New Mexico, Arizona, Oklahoma, as well as the Dakotas. And it's kind of across the 1970s and 80s as all of those stations kind of were founded. And many of them are still in operation and still vitally important in places where broadband is, a lot of rural radio stations do not have reliable broadband in people's homes. And so they can serve a really vital function, or even sometimes electricity or whatever. You'd still have a battery operated radio or something that it serves as a sort of community network in the way that, I assume that all of y'all's point of view about radio is like that it should serve the community. And it's the most, in some ways, the most vital use of that I can even imagine. Right.
So it sounds like,
yeah,
it sounds like
makes me think of small town. Makes me think of small town radio stations too, yeah, that are like community radio stations and also, right, emergency broadcasters. And they serve that purpose.
It sounds like that these radio stations were founded in the 70s and 80s around the same time that a lot of other community radio stations in across the United States. And it was, from what I'm hearing you say, Josh Garrett Davis, I'm assuming that it wasn't there wasn't any specific policy in the United States to try to grow radio in places where Native Americans lived. It's more that Native American people took advantage of community radios.
I think you all probably know better than I do about the federal government's sort of encouragement of community radio in the 60s and 70s more widespread. And I think that was sympathetic to Native people, but I think it was coming more from the ground up. Mm-hmm. That these stations were being founded, and that there are local particularities to different places, depending on how rural a certain place is. Oklahoma is a very particular point where there are dozens of tribes within a relatively small radius. And so as I was researching this, there's a book by Michael Keith that kind of goes into the history of those stations. I think he wrote it in the 1990s, called Signals in the Air. And he, from what I can tell, he corresponded, this is kind of pre-email in a lot of ways, like corresponded with a people from a lot of these stations and got kind of their responses of how they were founded and how they worked in the communities. And so for my research, I was kind of thinking, well, where did this start? Like, he's kind of done some of the work of telling that history. I need to kind of look for archives and things that I should work on for my dissertation, right? And when did this start? And sort of realizing what about before the 70s? What are the stories from then? And that became a much more manageable topic, except that I ended up also talking about sound recording, which it's not totally disconnected from radio in some ways. So,
just to add there, we did an episode of the show with Kyle Barnett, who talked a lot about the intersections between, right, the early recording industry and the early radio industry. So I appreciate that was the topic of your dissertation, because they were so intertwined.
Maybe this is a great opportunity. We should jump right into it. Josh Garrett Davis, tell us about the earliest examples of Native American sound recordings. How far back?
Yeah, so the history of Native American sound recordings is kind of deeply entwined, as you probably could imagine, with the field of anthropology. So in the late 19th century, the field of anthropology is kind of growing into an academic field in some way, and there are a lot of mostly non-Native, there's a few interesting examples of Native anthropologists who had this feeling that Native people and their cultures were going to disappear, and they had this fear about Indigenous people around the world to some extent, and they needed to document these cultures and before they vanished. And they've called Native American people the vanishing race. And so they fanned out across, there were people kind of from all sorts of, from museums, from universities and so on, to kind of going out and collecting material culture, stories, and songs and stories via sound recording. So the earliest surviving recordings are from 1890, where there was a community in Maine, Passamaquoddy community, was visited by a guy from Harvard named Jesse Walter Fuchs, and he brought a phonograph, and they performed stories and songs in the phonograph. There are probably a couple of examples from earlier, though the recordings haven't survived so far, or haven't been discovered so far.
And how were these on wax cylinders or wire recordings? What were all the different types of ways that those early ethnographers were recording Native Americans?
The mostly wax cylinders. They were those old phonographs could be sort of spring powered rather than electrical powered, so they traveled pretty well. And so even deep into the 20th century, some anthropologists were still using wax cylinders because they traveled better than like electric, like the kind of what you picture Alan Lomax having this car with this giant disc recorder in the back. That didn't work that well out in the like rural reservations in the West and stuff. So those wax cylinders kind of continued to work for quite a while. But there are some of the earliest disc recordings on the Berliner label are from 1895, and they're kind of an odd example. They're commercial records, and it turns out they were actually recorded by a white anthropologist, this guy James Mooney. He had recorded wax cylinders in Oklahoma. He spent a lot of time with people who were adherents of the ghost dance religion. And contrary to a lot of people's image, if you've learned about the ghost dance at all, you've probably learned about Lakota people practicing the ghost dance and then being slaughtered in mass at Wounded Knee in 1890, which did happen. But there were also ghost dance adherents throughout Indian country and a lot in Oklahoma, and it kind of evolved kind of with Pentecostalism and is sort of part of, in some ways, still practiced in some versions in a way. So it didn't like die out in a sense, but it was kind of a part of adaptive Native religions. And so James Mooney had spent a lot of time, especially with tribes in Oklahoma who had ghost dance groups, and he recorded some of these songs that they would compose as part of the ceremonies and things. But there isn't a way to transfer those kind of bad wax cylinder recordings to a disc. So he learned them and sang them himself in a studio in Washington, D.C. That whole phenomenon of ethnographic recording.
Who was the audience? I mean, not to interrupt, but who was the audience for the ethnographic recordings, and then also for this mimicked commercial disc that you're talking about?
Good question. I mean, I think they just saw themselves as building an archive. But one of the things that I try to suggest in reading, trying to sort of discern, why did these Native singers participate, right? Why share this stuff, right? And there's kind of the archives are always kind of incomplete and often interpreted by the anthropologist, who's usually not Native, but there is some indication that they too sought to create an archive, that it was actually for the future. And I think in the anthropologist's case, they saw it as the future of like posterity, of science, of like a record of human civilizations, right, for kind of some kind of vague future. But I think that the Native people were more specific in that it was for their own descendants, right? Like that there's there's a Native Hawaiian scholar called named Noinoi Silva who has a term of like genealogical consciousness that these early, this could be writers or singers or whoever are like speaking to future generations. And that's something that has interested me most. And it's an interesting aspect of, because for all the kind of misapprehensions about the vanishing race, 1900 was about the rock bottom for populations for a lot of tribes. And if you see the population losses across the 19th century, it's breathtaking, like 90% in some cases, right? And so a lot of knowledge was lost. I mean, there's no denying that. Yeah. And populations did begin to rebound and were rebounding throughout the 20th century to the present, and languages are coming back, but partly in with using these archives, whether it's the sound recordings or the or written things or photos or whatever, or material culture. So I have a, even though it's in a way the easiest thing is to kind of condemn these anthropologists because they're so grabby and like obsessive about vacuuming up all of these cultures, you know, but like at pinning, the same time,
like pinning, you know,
go ahead,
like pinning a specimen in a display, it's dehumanizing,
right? Totally. And but at the same time, the people actively participate, Native people actively participated, and they weren't being duped. Like they were smart people, you know, like they maybe in some cases they were coerced in some ways, not to say that that never happened, but I think many people did actively kind of participate in building these archives, and I think to some extent it was for their own communities in the future.
Josh Garrett, Josh Garrett Davis, you've described, we've gone back to the 1890s to talk about mostly white anthropologists recording Native American sounds, even though some Native American peoples were participants, not just subjects. And we began the conversation on today's episode talking about the Red Power era, which would be like the 1960s and 70s, where a lot of community radio stations flowered, and those would be examples of Native peoples using the radio to talk to Native people, as opposed to what we had in the 1890s. Is there something in the middle, in the early years of radio, where Native people were using their own voices with radio or recorded sounds?
Yeah, exactly. That's what I wanted to ask the same question, Eric, about when, at what point, because I know from reading a little bit of your research, there is this point where very early on you have Native American people who are controlling the means of production.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so great question. And I'm kind of passionate about, because that first half of the 20th century doesn't get that much attention in a lot of ways, in the ways that the Red Power movement put Native people in a public consciousness in a bigger way. Those probably 6 decades before that are often invisible to a broader audience, even though obviously within communities themselves they know they were there. So what was happening in those years, and it's hard, as you probably have talked to a lot of people who do research early radio, there's not great records of what was going on. So you're finding these mentions of people in text sources or in other sources. But there were some interesting examples. So in the 20s, as you know, radio starts to really take off, one of the kind of powerful examples that I came across, that I was sort of told about from the Six Nations or Haudenosaunee in like upstate New York and Ontario, kind of Canadian American borderlands of the Northeast, kind of a scholar from one of those communities had tipped me off to a guy named Levi General, who had a title, Discahe, a sort of ceremonial title. And he was in this fight with the both the Canadian and the U.S. government because they wanted to be able to cross freely across the border because their lands were on both sides of the border. He traveled to, at that point, it was the League of Nations, not the UN, to Geneva, to the League of Nations, to on a Haudenosaunee or sort of a Six Nations passport, and to try to lobby for this. And it was the Native American people gained citizenship, U.S. citizenship in 1924, and he was kind of among those who said, no, we don't want it. We don't. We are citizens of our own nations. Like, we predate your nation, and we are, you know... So he went, as he's fighting with both governments, he went and broadcast a big speech in, I think, 1924, 25 in Rochester, New York, and sort of saying, you know, I know that almost everyone listening to this, this is probably crossing both sides of the border, right? I know everyone that's listening to this is probably white, and I want you to ask your politicians, like, how did they gain the right to govern people who are not citizens of their nation? They're citizens of their own nations. And how did they, you know, the tribal sovereignty, the advocating for tribal sovereignty over the air to a mostly non-Native audience in a way, to sort of preserve this. And I think the 20s is when these moves toward how are tribes actually going to negotiate this sovereignty. They know that they can't militarily resist the United States at this point, right? Like you're, it's a global, at this point, a global empire. So how do you kind of carve out within the legal system, culturally, all these ways to kind of continue to exist as tribal entities, as governments, as kind of nations within these nations, within Canada or the United States or Mexico or Australia or New Zealand, wherever, you know, indigenous people are figuring out these sort of ways. And within the U.S. context, there's a lot of legal aspects to how that nationhood exists and how it, and it's, people are still fighting for, like, more sovereignty in a lot of ways over their own lands, right? So there's a couple of examples of that. And there's another example from the 20s of the government was really trying to crack down on religions that they deemed to be kind of heathen or non-Christian, and dances, and types of dances that they felt were dangerous to civilization in some way, right? There was a group of Hopi dancers from what's now Arizona, sort of, who went to the East Coast on a tour to sort of promote that they wanted to be able to continue these ceremonies. And they performed on the steps of the Capitol, but they also did radio. At least I know of at least one radio stop that they made where they sort of, I think in Schenectady, New York, sort of, you know, it's making their case. So there's, and then in more of like a popular culture realm, there were a lot of Native American performers who kind of played into and off of the stereotypical images of Native people. There were a few within kind of vaudeville and remaining types of Wild West shows and all sorts of sort of performance venues, but they also released records and they also performed on the radio doing kind of popular music or somewhat traditional music or whatever. And they, even though some of it seems sort of like stagey in a way now, but it some of them were involved in activism as well. And they kind of did keep Native people in a present day consciousness when a lot of people's ideas had consigned them to the past, right? So in a way, and there were, at that same time, there were really famous ballet dancers who were Native American. There were famous baseball players who were Native American. Like, it was in the sort of teens, 20s, even into the 30s, there were sort of possibilities, I think, for Native people in popular culture to kind of play Indian, as this sort of saying is, but also sort of negotiate space within sort of what modern American popular culture would be. And so that was, and I'm relying a lot on this, a great scholar named Phil Deloria, who has a book called Indians in Unexpected Places, about a lot of this moment. But there's a radio component to this, where there are, it's a mouthpiece, but again, the audience is presumed to be non-native, right?
And are like, these, and I assume these are non-native run stations too, because right. That's what I'm also wondering about. You mentioned that there were Native Americans who were releasing records. So when are some of these earliest, at what point do we see Native Americans who are deciding to run their own radio stations or record labels? And I'm curious, when that switch occurs, as opposed to being in these white spaces, for a lack of a better term, versus, mm-hmm. Carving out their own place in the media.
Yeah. So as far as I can tell, it's around the 1940s when there starts to be some more opportunities, and it's still not owning a whole station. But there are a few examples of small record labels in the 1940s.
What would they be releasing compared with maybe what when you saw Native American performers on some of these other labels before the 40s, what was the focus when Native American peoples decided to create their own labels?
Yeah, so I think it would be for creating their own labels, they're recognizing that there's a Native audience for Native American music, right? Like, so there, throughout the early 20th century, especially in Oklahoma and then on the northern, and a kind of into New Mexico, and then on the northern plains kind of separately, there's the development of like the powwow circuits of that are kind of intertribal communities that are created through people kind of going around to different powwows, especially in the summer. And there's a lot of new genres of music being created. There's a whole genre in Oklahoma of these 49 songs that are kind of it's kind of like a country lyrics, often in English, but very short, but set in like a powwow sort of frame. So there's like some about an old car. Like there's a song called One-Eyed Ford that's an old classic from back then, or stuff like Broken Heart kind of songs and things like that. But it's in within like the powwow music kind of idiom of with sort of drums and singing and stuff. But no labels were releasing that. No non-native labels were releasing records of that stuff. So there's kind of
it probably wasn't being played on the radio. I mean, this also mm-hmm. reminds me of another episode we did about how African American preachers, would release records because they weren't necessarily getting radio airtime. Preachers on Wax is a project of Lerone Martin, and is that similar to what's going on here, where there's this material that is of interest to a community, but there's no way to hear it on the radio?
Yeah, I think there was basically, I mean, we may still kind of come across other shows that existed in certain places. But yeah, I think that the labels are realizing there's this need. And there was like kind of a whole home recording. There was kind of a blurry line between home recording and selling those home recordings within the community, or mass producing them on a very small kind of a la carte scale. So there were a few people in Oklahoma doing this, and a few people in New Mexico, and I think in Chicago, kind of releasing pretty small batch records. And then there's a kind of the kind of culmination of my dissertation's narrative in a lot of ways is this radio show in Oklahoma called the Indians for Indians Hour. And that is kind of, I think, a pretty big turning point and kind of a signal moment in Native American radio. And hadn't been recognized, I don't think, as such, like hasn't gotten, but it's recently, the archive has been digitized. University of Oklahoma has recently digitize the archive. They did an exhibit this last year. It kind of got closed early with COVID and everything. Mm.
Are we able to hear any of that material?
Yeah, it's on the Western History Collections website at the University of Oklahoma. The archivist there, Lina Ortega, did a ton of work, did a book called The Indians for Indians Hour. I wrote an article about it. So it's kind of like just now getting kind of, even though people in those communities kind of knew about this and it was on tape, it had been put on tape at a certain point. So people knew that their own ancestors were on the show. I'll give you a little background of us first. Okay,
yeah, tell us.
We want to hear about the show. Yeah. What was on the show?
Josh Garrett Davis, you're joining us on Radio Survivor today, and you're going to tell us now about this radio show, The Indians for Indians Hour.
The Indians for Indians Hour, though its technical name was just Indians for Indians, and it was only half an hour long. Uh-huh. But he always said, so this was founded in 1941 by a guy named Don Whistler, who is Sac and Fox. It's a tribe in Oklahoma. Sac and Fox name was Keshkakosh, and he would always sort of introduce the show coming in. He'd say, Aho Nikon, Keshkakosh Anina, or something. So he's saying, hey, friends, it's Keshkakosh is here. So kind of using the indigenous language, and he was kind of I forgot to mention a major figure in Native American radio prior to this, who is Will Rogers. Will Rogers was a citizen of the Cherokee Nation and occasionally did bring up Native American issues in his huge fame, in especially in the 20s and 30s.
It might be useful to let people know who aren't familiar with Will Rogers, who was so famous it's almost embarrassing to ask a question like this, but I think in the year 2021, it's useful to ask you, who was Will Rogers and why was he so famous?
Okay. Short answer, Will Rogers was a huge star who kind of started off, I think, as a trick roper. He was the Cherokee cowboy in some Wild West shows. I think he performed in a Wild West show in South Africa for some time, but ended up, you know, making his way to Hollywood. I don't actually know how often the radio show was, but he was a huge national radio sensation, was in movies, was, you know, released comedy records. I mean, I've heard someone say, you know, that he was kind of like the Daily Show, right? Like, it was kind of like commenting on current events with this humorous, down-to-earth kind of feel, and had this down-home Oklahoma way of speaking, and was a citizen of the Cherokee Nation, and did occasionally, like he said, sort of, you know, this is in the era of like now, a kind of anti-immigrant sentiment, and so people were very much on who's 100% American and who is a Mayflower descendant, and he said, well, my ancestors didn't come over on the Mayflower, they met the boat, even though not literally, they didn't literally meet the boat, they were further south than that, but you know, he was sort of poking fun at nativism by saying, oh, who's the real native?
That's
here,
really
right?
Funny, because yeah. You know, we got off on a tangent about Will Rogers, and we're going to get back to Natives for Natives Radio Hour. Yeah. That was a half an hour show, but what's amazing is I didn't know that Will Rogers wasn't white until today.
Yeah.
So there you go. And I
now you knew. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So,
and that was obviously a huge part of his cultural identity, but it didn't make it into his short bio that I learned about in the 1980s.
Yeah. Well, and he, you know, he died tragically young in a plane crash, and sort of didn't get, I think maybe is partly why he isn't as widely remembered as he should be for how famous he was at the time. But anyway, the reason I sort of brought him up was because Don Whistler, who was the host of Indians for Indians, had a kind of a Will Rogers-esque, like a really friendly, down-home, welcoming host vibe. And so I've listened to like so many of these shows. And so sort of drawing from that.
How many are there? So it was a weekly show?
It was a weekly show, and he recorded
in the 1940s.
He recorded them on 16-inch discs mostly. They were 15 minutes on each side. So halfway through the show, they'd flip it over and record on the other side.
Wow.
And he didn't record every single show, but they recorded, there are over 100 from when his tenure, and he actually passed away quite young in 1951. But the show kept going and is actually still on the air today. We'll get to that.
So these discs that they would record live in his studio would then be distributed to other radio stations and air throughout the country.
This was at the University of Oklahoma in Norman, Oklahoma. And he basically got this one show at in the studio there. And it was a kind of community radio station in a sense. I mean, it had a lot of educational programming, this sort of extension service, agricultural extension service type things, town hall of the air type, those types of programs. And then they had this, which were all like, you hear little bits of those on the beginning or end of the recording, and it's so stilted. And then he comes on, he's like, hey, we're ready to go. And he was recording them. I think that kind of for posterity. Again, it's like part of this tradition of recording. He mentions on one show, like, we're putting this good Indian music on discs to save for a long, long time. But he also used them to play if he didn't have a guest one week, he would play an old show. And so basically this show revolved around guests. So it's such a cool model of community radio. Yeah. So
tell us the host's name again. It's worth repeating.
Don Whistler. So, and he, among his other, many other resume lines or whatever you want to say, he was the first elected chief of the Sac and Fox tribe after they kind of reorganized the system of electing tribal councils in the 30s. In 1938, he became chief, which he had to commute up a little ways to from Norman, where the university is, to the reservation to serve as chief. And he was until he passed away. So for over 10 years, he was doing that. Also, you have the powwow circuit going on. And so there are this is an AM station, of course, so it's a pretty big radius. There were probably 24 different tribes within that radius. And it overlapped pretty clearly with the powwow circuit. So he is bringing in performers every week from different, but not just powwow groups. There's there's church groups. There's a whole tradition of especially Kiowa, Comanche, Apache, hymns in those languages, Christian hymns. There's also the Native American church or peyote religion is kind of growing at that time. There were some kind of intertribal political meetings that would be happening and they would broadcast.
What were some of the things that really have struck you listening to all of these hours? What have been some of the exciting, interesting moments to you?
I really like, he did announcements, both. And he actually tried to keep the announcements on the break when they were flipping over the records because they weren't useful for him on the future shows. But you'd catch 10 or 15 seconds of that before the disc flips over. That's what's so striking to me was like the communication between him and the audience. And so there's some striking things are like people would send a telegram to him the morning of the show and say, we're bringing a group next week if it's okay. And then he reads on the air, I just got this telegram. So our group next week is, so-and-so is coming in. And they're going to be great. And he could let them know if there was someone else booked or something, right? Like that. So because, I don't think phone would have been necessarily reliable at that point. So he's getting a telegram or a postcard sometimes from a group saying, can we come in 2 weeks or whatever? And so that, feedback loop of communicating that as well as, events. And then there are a few moments he kind of tried to stay out of politics because especially you know, tribal politics, like within a tribe, like just want, he, I think they just wanted to stay out of that. Like you didn't want to get in the middle of like a, an election, but the, around that same time was the National Congress of American Indians, which is still the sort of major intertribal activist group or organization, nationally. They were founded around then. So he would do announcements for them of like, you know what, there's this dangerous bill in Congress that's going to take away our sovereignty in some way. Write to your senators right now, send a postcard, here's the address, and stuff like that. And I guess the other striking thing, is the role of this show in the boarding school system. And so that's a big part of Native American history in the early 20th century I haven't gotten to, which is there was a massive system of removing children from their families and taking them to boarding schools, sometimes really far from home. And
which is genocide.
Yes, yes. and sort of, you know, there was, and literally often, you know, many, many students died at these schools, especially in the early, you know, the first ones are in the 1870s and then go up to, well, there are still some bodies, but these schools begin to transform to become something more positive sometimes in some people's lives. I mean, that in the 30s, there started to be some more Native teachers within these schools. There started to be kind of, instead of trying to erase culture, to try to encourage language, or, well, it took a while. It's taken a while for
the
language to be. It's very complicated, but anyway, for all the different situations under which these students were in these schools by the 1940s, which weren't quite as dire as they had been earlier, but still had some huge, terrible aspects. To say that's putting it so mildly, I probably, it's, yeah, like,
but we're
offensive.
Talking about the radios.
Sorry.
And how
we're talking about the radio. Okay, so there's students listening to this in a system that was at least initially set up to totally erase their cultures. There's students listening every week at school to this program, and in fact, there started to be kind of Indian clubs within these schools that would do singing, and they would come and travel 100 miles to be on this radio show, and they would be hearing on other broadcasts from elders from maybe their own tribe or another tribe sort of speaking and singing over the air. So that sort of way that it was somewhat hopefully overcoming in some ways that the
providing that window to their cultures. Yeah. Yeah. That's an amazing use of radio. And you think about that across so many situations where somebody might feel so alone, but then hear something on the radio that allows mm-hmm. them to feel like they're part of a community.
Well, and what's very exciting to me listening to you talk about the history, Josh Garrett Davis, of this radio program, which was, again, tell me the name and the host.
Indians for Indians with Don Whistler.
That this show in the 1940s sounds to me like community radio, which hadn't been invented yet. Community radio, as I understand it, in the United States comes along a decade later. And this sounds like to me like community radio, like a big tent of you know, folding a lot of different cultures around, you know, wrapping your arms around a lot of cultures that have a common mm-hmm. a common goal, and talking into microphones to share that with an audience. The audience is what matters the most, and then as well as playing records, like the sound of a community was being broadcast with this show.
And that the audience was, you know, they were performers, right? Like that it was like that the audience and the performers and the relationship it had to the real world, or it is real world, but to in the flesh events and to other forms of community. And then, you know, after he passed away kind of suddenly of a heart attack in 1951, it continued kind of run through the universities. I think it was called the Sequoia Club. And in fact, at least one student who became a major Red Power activist in the 60s was host for some time at the University of Oklahoma. So named Clyde Warrior. So that's like that connection to that next generation, and where sort of Don Whistler's generation, the activists were more, you know, it was the 40s and 50s. It was much more like buttoned up a little bit, you know, or sort of like there was that sort of cultural propriety or something, you know, that sort of it's good church going folk. And I don't know. I mean, it's another thing I wanted to mention is like he always cooked for the group that was performing at his house beforehand, right? So he just had to make a huge pot of soup or whatever, and this sometimes there'd be like 30 people in the studio, right, on a given performance. It would be a huge group coming in and singing, so he had to feed 30 people at his house or something, you know, before the show. So there's this sort of exchange, and these, you know, within a lot of communities, throughout Native America, actually, there's sort of different forms of sort of giveaway ceremonies, and hospitality is super important in that way, and as a way of building community and giving gifts and feeding people and so on. So this was kind of all tied up into that, and I think kind of forms this kind of early model. And yeah, that the form of the community radio that you'd hear on those other shows were like, I think I went and looked at that station's filings through the FCC at the National Archives, and to be like, this is the university station, did they like realize how amazing this show was, right? Like, were they, and they didn't highlight it at all. They were like, the shows that they would highlight in their FCC showing their kind of public service were like, we do Town Hall of the Air, where men of great expertise on these topics will come and rationally debate and whatever, you know. It's sort of, that was the idea of kind of community public service radio, in that sense, which has its value too, but it wasn't really community, you know, community rooted. It's these, like,
well, it's not what that, yeah, it's not what that radio station is going to be remembered for.
Exactly.
100 years well, from now. Like, it sounds to me like this is their legacies. This show is the most important thing.
Well, and it's making me think, I don't know if I know of any other radio show that has been on the air since 1941. So, I mean, this is potentially the longest running radio show.
Oh, did you say cool. It was still on the air?
Yeah. It's so in the 1970s, I think the station, they were kind of transferred it to a commercial station, and then they made the show, instead of being on like Tuesday afternoons, it became on like Sunday morning or Saturday morning, when those kind of public service. But at some point in, I think, the 80s, it moved to, now it's on an FM station in southwestern Oklahoma, and it's a smaller radius. It's about 4 or 5 tribes are in that area, and it's Indians for Indians is on now. It's like a country station. It's 3 hours. It's sponsored by the Comanche Nation, and the host is a guy named Edmund Macete, who is Comanche, and he kind of like hosts this 3-hour show once a week. But it's not quite that like that huge radius, sure, and the bigger community, but it is still going.
Well, our thanks to the guest on today's episode, Josh Garrett Davis, associate curator at the Autry Museum and author of a recently completed dissertation, Resounding Voices, Native Americans and Sound Media, 1890 to 1970. You've been listening to Radio Survivor. A longer version of this episode is available on radiosurvivor.com and our podcast, which you can get anywhere where podcasts are subscribed to. My name is Eric Klein. On behalf of Jennifer Waits, who produced this week's episode, and Paul Reese-Mendel, thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next week.